Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Welcome to Bristol's first podcast. Yes, Dialect goes out every Friday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Miscarriages of justice growing in Britain, in part due to the extinction of investigative TV documentaries such as the BBC's Rough Justice. But fear not, to the rescue is Victims Unite, the website, and also the editor joining us today again, Sabine McNeil. More too in our weekly series with Peruvian-born US filmmaker Alan Frankovich. Plus, Jason Yannakopoulos on some of this week's news stories. Also, Kazza is here from Wales to tell us about his experiences complaining to the DSS. So, straight away, joining me is Sabine McNeil on the line. Hi, Sabine, and welcome to Dialect.
Hi, Tony.
Now, this week, you've been to see Melissa in Holloway. Can you just tell us a bit about her case?
Oh, yes. I just summarised it for a couple of MPs, or rather, two new ones, in addition to John Hemming MP, who is always on the forefront of anything to do with child snatching. Melissa was introduced to me by another prisoner, and she is incredibly remarkable because she used to be a legal secretary, so she is able to stand her ground. And a completely bizarre allegation is that she supposedly abducted her own son, would you believe it? And that can happen because Barnett Social Services thought that she was somebody else, which she has always denied. But her lawyer advised her to plead guilty. And, of course, on some level, I mean, first of all, she happened to have been drugged at the time. She suffers from arthritis and had fallen seriously and has just suffered on so many different levels that I'm really curious whether MPs are going to be involved and help, because her sentence actually finished on June 30th. She was taken in Spain and was lured into signing a piece of paper to extradite her son. So her son was then put into care. She hasn't seen him since. He was 4 years old at the time. She, after 12 days in prison in Spain, was taken to Holloway, and I began to visit her in March, but only had what they call a social visit, i.e. we could never help with papers getting in and out, so one had to rely on one's memory, and until I discovered that there are bits of paper that one can also take notes on, to take out, but nothing to take in, and I haven't been able to see any of her legal documentation at all.
Yeah, I mean, with all cases like this, Sabine, one of the basic facts is, I mean, how certain are you? I mean, obviously, for somebody who has had a child knows in their own heart that it's their child, but can this be actually proven in this case?
Well, there was an attempt. The U.S. Embassy got involved, and they wanted to get a DNA test done, or suggested to get that done, but, I mean, it is just very obvious, because and actually that is not the question anymore, and it wasn't really questioned either, but the DNA test that the US embassy only wanted a particular lab where instead of £99 it would have cost something like £700, and so we didn't manage to raise the funds to get that DNA test done. But meanwhile, I mean, let's face it, the priority is A, to get her out, especially because her sentence finished on June 30th. I mean, it's quite some time ago.
Well, so why is she still in jail?
Well, you see, this is the UK Border Agency which holds her on what they call immigration issues. And I was there at when bail was refused, and they went back to some history when she was in the UK more or less as a student and overstayed her visa then. So therefore, it was felt that she wasn't respecting the immigration laws. I mean, that to me is not enough of a reason not to give her bail, but to the UK Border Agency it was at the time.
Well, I think there's quite a lot of people right across Britain who are evading immigration law. She wouldn't be the only one. So she's not actually a British citizen then?
No, she's an American citizen.
Okay, so how's the case progressing? And do you think that she's going to get her son back?
Oh, I very much hope so, but I can't say at this point, because she was hopeful when, contrary to the comment of a family lawyer, she was given permission to appeal, but the appeal was now refused, no merit, and out of time was the answer, even though the judge hadn't even seen the complete bundle. And of course she has a tremendously hard time to put a bundle of any paperwork together in prison. I mean, the prison actively prevent her, they didn't produce her, if that's the technical term, in court hearings. She went on a 62-day hunger strike to get heard and got at least some kind of apology at some stage. But it is, I really keep praying that she will get her child back, but who knows?
What about the father? Is there a father around somewhere?
No, actually, she says it's a test tube baby.
Ah, it doesn't help, does it? But, I mean, she has her own bit of expertise, being a legal secretary. Now, imagine many of the people that you see, Sabine, don't have that even.
No, and that's why it is a joy working with her and actually getting somewhere. But also, quite frankly, if it wasn't for me and another Mackenzie friend, nobody would care whether she dies in prison or whatever happens to either her or her son. And actually, it's very clearly the pattern of these child snatchers. They want to make sure that they target foreigners, they get deported, and the kids get adopted. That's the process.
Okay,
that's
so
what I've not observed.
I mean, this isn't the first such case that you've dealt with. The child snatcher in this place being apparently a London local authority. Who's to blame for these kinds of cases, do you think?
I can't name and shame yet. I mean, any sort of one local authority after another is said to be the worst. I think they are all more or less equal.
So, I mean, is it the lawyers within these local authorities? Is it the social services departments?
Yes, social services, but they are always colluding with police, with schools, with NHS, and they have their legal teams.
Okay, another post on your blog, I notice, a recent one, is about white-collar crime. Now, you don't necessarily think of child snatching as a form of white-collar crime.
Yes, I discovered that the common denominator are falsified official documents. That's how I really spotted the first gagging order that I got from Swansea Council at the time. It was visibly falsified. I couldn't take it seriously, but I kind of had to because they had approached WordPress and had closed my blog down. And of course I kind of had to tell WordPress, look, we are dealing with problems in the UK, and so eventually I got them to cooperate with me rather than with them. But it is a white collar crime because they falsify so-called expert reports. They just pay whoever gives them the right kind of report. It's really quite tragic to see a kind of a false shield of justice and a supposed lawfulness, and in reality it is just one, I cannot call it anything other but a white collar crime, because they are all white collar people and who just commit one crime after another.
But I mean, surely, I mean, there are ombudsmen, there are all sorts of checks and balances in society that make sure, I wasn't being ironic, but I mean, surely there are. I mean, people can actually appeal these things, and officials that are acting unlawfully for whatever reason can get brought to book. I mean, we've just had, for example, April Casburn, a detective in the Metropolitan Police, sent down to jail for giving information to the News of the World that they were being investigated by the Met. Basically, she was acting as a mole for Rupert Murdoch and his empire within, right in the heart of Scotland Yard. I mean, so to a certain extent, there are, you know, sometimes people do face measures and justice and go to court because of this.
Well, unfortunately, my bias is completely formed from sad, bad cases I have done. Good cases don't come to me. And what I've seen in terms of bankruptcies, in terms of home repossessions, in terms of insolvencies, as well as in terms of child snatching, is just one terrible case of injustice after the other. And for me, that child snatching is just kind of the worst of all possible crimes. I mean, to lose your home is nothing to compare to losing your children, and on top of it, being criminalized through a fake court. court and then ending up in prison innocently. So talking about checks and balances, look, the family courts are secret, first of all. So there is not even the kind of publicity avenue is open.
I mean, do not the family courts have a public gallery? I mean, the court system in Britain, I mean, certainly the Crown Courts, the County Courts, the High Court, all have public galleries. You can just watch justice taking place. I mean, surely even the family courts don't stop anybody actually watching what's happening. I mean, that's the whole point of justice, surely, that it's seen to be done.
Tony, wake up to the reality that I've experienced. Thanks to Camilla Cavendish and her campaign with the Times, professional journalists are admitted to the public gallery. Otherwise, you are not allowed. No admittance to the public. I was recently in Court 33 in the appeal court for such a situation. I was asked to leave. I thought it was an open court, but it wasn't. This is absolute general practice. Only one Mackenzie friend allowed in if the parents represent themselves. In the worst of all cases that I've observed, the judge announced that he was following the directives of his senior colleague, who was the then president of the family court, and he did not allow the public gallery to take notes.
Well, that's bizarre. Never heard of anything like that. Well, I mean, certainly seems like you're up against quite a dark force there, because ultimately, I mean, this is all done in the interest, supposedly, of keeping the children's names anonymous, and there's no reason why the judge can't make an order to keep those names anonymous, but people could still be in the court at the time. I mean, that's the way it works. And of course, if either the public or journalists break that order and do name the children, then they themselves will be put in jail for contempt of court. So it's not as if there's no checks and balances there. And it seems, well, why is it then, do you think, that these family courts do exclude both bloggers like yourself and ordinary members of the public?
Well, I can only conclude that, and quite frankly, Tony, I did not know about paedophilia when I watched these child snatching cases, or when they came my way. And I can only now know that I need to join the dots between the purpose, i.e. paedophilia, or money, and or both. And because it is a huge industry, this foster business, it's actually social service workers who set up adoption agencies, contact centers, who get a kickback from foster parents, who get £400 a week per child as a minimum in general. And an adoption agency was sold for, I can't remember, but huge price. And it is an industry.
Yeah, it sounds amazing that the foster care company can be sort of traded on the open market, almost like on the stock exchange or something.
Quite. An adoption company. I mean, it is. And the number of kids that will get adopted is minute compared to those who get put into care. And then, I mean, if you look at the statistics, there's an incredible person called Ian Josephs who lives in Monaco, who's been following cases for about 40 years. And he published a website called forced-adoption.com, and I revamped that into Punishment Without Crime and organized the contents a bit more visible, and so highlighted, for example, the statistics about the kids and about the money, and it is truly shocking. And he gets about 6 cases a day.
Well, Sabine, the other white-collar crimes that you list here, we've just touched on the surface there, just talking about child snatching. You also talk about financial fraud, false imprisonment, unlawful home repossessions, fraudulent bankruptcies, paedophilia, and also Satanism. But maybe we'll talk about some of those in future weeks. But until then, just a reminder of your website, which is still there at the moment. WordPress haven't taken it down this week. It's www.victims-unite. That's victims-unite.net. So, Sabine, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much indeed, Tony.
Right, well, I'm joined in the studio now by Kazza, a local man. Kazza, you do want to keep your proper name anonymous, but give us a little bit of an introduction. Why have you come in today?
Oh, well, thanks for having me on, Tony. I've come in because I heard your shout out on Friday Drive Time, and basically I've had a whole litany of complaints with Job Centre Plus, been right through the process from the Job Centre all the way up to Independent Case Examiner and now with the Ombudsman. But what I've actually been doing is just logging and recording complaints, which are either, you know, of concern or very serious, and I've got some very serious stuff, and just gone through that process.
Okay, so when did you? So you've actually been making complaints to the Job Centre. When did you first start doing that, and what about?
Okay, well, it all starts way back before the work programme, back at when there was Flexible New Deal. Basically, I went through three providers. I complained about the first one after about 14 weeks of nothing, apart from some racist comments. I had to go to the director of the Job Centre District Office that then reneged on an agreement to find suitable next provision. They tried to force me with the next provider, and I had a rather unhappy phone call from a sort of an unhinged, aggressive thug shouting at me down the phone. Their manager refused to take a formal complaint.
Was that the Job Centre or the provider that?
That was the second provider, which meant I couldn't go to them. And their manager actually said they didn't actually have provision that would be suitable for me anyway.
Okay, so these complaints were fundamentally about the fact that you were that these training providers were supposed to be helping you get into work, but they weren't actually helping you get into work.
Yeah,
they're paid with taxpayers' money to do that.
Absolutely.
And it's quite legitimate for someone who feels that they're not actually getting any kind of service to complain about it.
Yeah, I mean, I even went to the self-employed option that they should have put me on the first place, and then I was bumped into REMPLOY even without my knowledge. But basically, yes, these providers were supposed to be providing help and provision and support, and it was supposed to be individualised. That's a key point. But I, after a bit of research and complaining, I found out that actually there was no qualified individuals involved who could actually provide anything of any help or support whatever. So I became sort of ultra cautious about this. So basically I had a collection of complaints that were about the Job Centre, the District Office, the Chief Executive Office, it was called then, itself. Quite a few incidents of responsibility avoidance, misconduct by contractors and their bullying behaviour. A bit of defamation and slander chucked in there.
Yes. But when you say bullying, that's a difficult thing to define sometimes. Quite often people who are being bullied would see it they're being bullied. But, isn't that to a certain extent what these training providers have got to do? They've actually got to force you in a way to apply for jobs that you might otherwise not want to do.
I had threats all the way. And this was when that was coming in, that sort of your benefits may be affected. But it was always took the form in every single interaction of you will be sanctioned, and I would get that verbally every time, and also in writing. There was also data mishandling, giving my data out left, right and centre to these people when I hadn't actually signed up with them. And on top of that, my research started that there was actually no bona fide complaint process there at all. So that got my interest.
We've heard in the news recently quite a lot about complaints about the work programme, but this is, have you actually been making complaints about that too since that came in about 18 months or so?
Okay, well, I'm having a bit of a funny experience with the work programme because I was then about to go on it. I had lots of travel issues. I live quite rurally, and so the car was breaking down. So I had to get a lift with a delivery man I know. He would give me a lift to another Job Centre, so I'd have to sign off and register with another one. And that kept changing. I kept getting the appointment to be referred to the work programme. Now, at that time, with the Chief Executive Office and going into the Information Commissioners, Independent Case Examiners, I was expecting a result of my complaints. And Serco actually agreed, and this is quite key, to give
Who are they? Serco?
Well, Serco were the people that were the big master company that were doing all these fly-by-night providers.
So this is the private contractor that had been contracted by the Department of
Work.
This
is before the work programme. They actually agreed to give me individualised bespoke provision. And so I was exploring that. And then they reneged on that as well. And basically they ignored me until the Flexible New Deal had timed out, and then said, well, that's it, we're not going to do it. And I was like, well, actually, I'd like it now, if you don't mind. And so then we were on to the work programme, and I was changing job centre. I changed job centre about 6 or 7 times.
But was that all because of the place where you live and you were finding it difficult to get into?
I couldn't travel... by bus. There just aren't buses, so it was a bit of a comic routine. I actually felt a bit like I was on the run, and they thought I was sort of ducking and diving, but actually I didn't want to inconvenience myself or them when I was getting this offer through. And it soon transpired that this was going to be reneged on, and I was never going to get it. So now that I'm with my job centre with the work programme, I'm still chasing that. So what I'm doing when I get an appointment, my initial appointment for the work programme, I'm not saying this is my strategy, but you can sign off, say, the day before, and then all bets are off. You don't have to attend anything, and then which anybody is entitled to do. And then the day after, say, an appointment, or if you've had a break, you can then do a rapid reclaim, and you're fine on that. So I had quite a bit of delay.
I mean, do you have a problem with the whole idea of the work programme? I mean, what do you? Well, since that's kicked in, you've done these complaints with the previous system.
Yeah.
And really, I think your point being really that you don't feel the complaint system is. It's not just that you're unhappy about the decisions that have been made, but there isn't actually you feel a proper complaint system in place to actually guarantee that this public money that's being spent on these private providers is being spent well.
As in the Flexible New Deal, the work programme. It's a lottery. Sometimes you might get a good one. You might get a qualified person. That's fine. I would advise everybody to check it out. And if there's something there for you, by all means, go for it. But if they're not qualified and you know there's going to be no help and support, what you're actually doing is sort of indulging in a sort of fraud. So it's actually much easier for me to have a day off and then go back on job seeker's allowance. And the thing is, your job seeker's allowance is based on a job seeker's agreement. And that's fine. I've done mine. I'm okay with that. But then that agreement changes into a different contract where a third party can then just crap the whip, tell you to do something, endanger you financially if you don't do it, irregardless if it's helpful or supportive or not. And if they don't get their money, that's the road they'll go down.
Well, I mean, I must say I've had a bit of experience of this myself, in that when I first went onto the work programme, one of the things that they do is occasionally, rather than going in, they'll phone you. For whatever reason, the phone call didn't get through to me on my mobile.
Well, that's it.
I didn't answer my mobile. Yeah. I then got a letter through in the post saying your benefits. Well, I think I had to actually write in and say, explain exactly why I hadn't picked the phone up, and they didn't even tell me that I hadn't. It just said you have been sanctioned. You got to explain why you didn't attend. Now, hang on a minute, but I wasn't actually supposed to attend.
Well, that's when.
And they were threatening to cut my benefit. I think it said something like 60 weeks, up to 60 weeks. That's whatever. Well, that is. That's over a year.
430
to take away your benefits for that amount of time. Now that is part of something which is supposed to be helping you get work, and it seems that.
It's completely counterproductive, isn't it?
There's a kind of... it seems it's a whole load of extra unnecessary hoops that you've got to jump through in order to actually get benefit that you're entitled to.
Yeah, I mean, they're saying, oh, you're not available for work or whatever, but that's when it gets quite skewy, because whichever provider will have a different regime of how they do it, and if they don't like you, well, they can just target you with whatever they want. I mean, I've
seen bullying actually going on within the work programme, with this I suppose they're advisors, they're called, talking to one of these unemployed people, saying basically standing over him and saying, well, what's wrong with you, you know?
Yeah.
This is actually, you know, it's the idea that it's your fault because you haven't met the standards of employers. I mean, actually, the guy concerned did seem like he had maybe possibly learning difficulties or something.
Yeah, yeah.
I found it actually really distasteful to see this going on.
And it's totally out of kilter, because the first thing you've got to ask yourself when you go to a work programme provider is this person qualified? Are they a recruitment person? Do they have a recruitment qualification? Are they experienced in recruitment? I mean, I am actually seeking work, so I talk to good recruitment agencies, people that are actually experienced and qualified. These people are not, it seems. I haven't heard of a single one that is.
Back to your complaints. Let's carry on. How did you get on with
them? If I could just
add
to that, actually, because people need to be aware of their rights. Because you don't have to sign anything with the work programme and you don't have to sign the data protection waiver. Freedom of information is a fact from DWP. You don't have to sign anything and they can't make you do anything. But of course they can bring in this regime, as they say, and it, for vulnerable people, it's very unnerving.
Okay, so your complaints, how did they go? With the work programme?
So I had a good collection, a bundle of complaints, which I then took to the Independent Case Examiner. Now, the key thing about them, they're supposed to be independent. And later I found out that that wasn't necessarily the case. What they did with me, and this is what I believe they deliberately tried to scupper my complaint. I sent them all the evidence, emails, communications, letters, had everything banged to rights, basically. But they worked to a strategy which was not advertised on the website. And basically, it's all about elements of complaint. And you have to decide that and agree that first, and then they act on those elements of complaint. So you've got to draw those elements of complaint up with them. What they did with me, I said, look, this is quite complicated. There's a hundred and odd pages of this stuff. You need to have a good hour's discussion for me just so you understand what everything that's gone on. They said, yeah, that's no problem. I didn't get any discussion. Phone rang twice. I was in the shower, missed it. I thought, well, I'll phone them back. They want a discussion. I was busy. I'll do it next
morning.
Even
with that, sometimes they withhold the number, so you don't know that they've actually
phoned. I knew it was them because I 1471'd it and I got them.
Yeah, well, you're lucky because several times I've been phoned by the Department for Work and Pensions. It's a number withheld number, and if you miss it, that's it. And then you can possibly be sanctioned for that. You can't even phone them back.
Yeah, absolutely. So I got up the next day to phone them back, and guess what? I had a letter through the post, which was already with some elements of complaint, and it was... I had about 13 to 15 elements of complaint on the go, and they could be rewritten or whatever as long as it featured the key elements of understanding. But these were like four elements of complaint that were just completely ridiculous. I mean, it was almost like a child had written it, and it was a very inexperienced member of staff. But you just thought, this is unbelievable. I was so angry.
You were being asked to agree to this, were you?
These are what I've read it, and this is what I understand. These four elements of complaint, and it was just so it wouldn't even come near to representing part of the elements of complaint that I had. So what I did then, I referenced the whole lot, wrote my elements of complaint, sent them in. I had a long chat with the manager. Yes, oh, I see you've referenced it all now. So I said, right, you can't deny this stuff doesn't exist. So I had it absolutely locked down. The next thing, I get a phone. Let me read you these. Do these represent your elements? No, I disagree with those entirely. So what they'd actually done is they had set about very cleverly rewriting stuff and reframing it. And this is a key element, this reframing. But you could tell that the elements of complaint they wrote were designed to fail. And there was no point going ahead with them because they would. So we had a load of like letter tennis backwards and forwards. And in the end, I just said, look, I'll accept these if you can show me how mine fit into yours, which is blatantly impossible, but I want it in writing. And
they wouldn't sound like a proper complaints process when the people you're complaining about are actually deciding what you're basing your complaint on. Now, one of the things that you said earlier, which really rang alarm bells with me, is about data. The idea that your personal private data might be handed over to people that you don't wish it to be and inappropriate. So can you tell us about that? Because that is a big worry in the modern world.
Okay, well, I've had quite a bit of success actually using SARs, which are subject access requests, freedom of information questions, and I've also
that's
taken,
under the Data Protection Act, I think, isn't
that's
it?
Right.
SARs,
Well, both freedom of information and is it Freedom of Information Act, of course, and subject access requests. You can do that under the Data Protection Act, so you can get all the data about you. And I would recommend people you get your whole file, and I think there's something called the LMU database file, which is everything they write about you in the job centre when they're tapping their keys, and that's all the appointments and everything. Now I uncovered a whole hornet's nest.
Does that cost?
It should usually cost. They can charge you £10 for up to something like 600 odd sides. But when I've written in, I've said, look, you obviously know I'm unemployed. I can't afford this. There shouldn't be that much. I've only asked for my whole lot once, which came in a big bundle, and everything after I've been very specific. I only want this, or I only want this bit of data, which you'll find here, and just, or how is this processing done about me here?
Well, that's fascinating. I mean, when you got that bundle through the post and started flicking through it, was anything there that struck
you as
a little bit?
There's a real problem here, Tony, because every single application I've made, I've always had a specific purpose. I've never done anything vexatious. And every single one I've done has always come back, oh, we understand you want, you know, I've said I want ABC, and they say, oh, we understand you want XYZ. And it's always this reframing. So I've always had to have like two or three goes just to get what I want. So I've had about five totally unnecessary bundles. I mean, I've got a filing cabinet size of this totally irrelevant database stuff, so my shredder's very happy. But the stuff that I've uncovered, I actually went through. I should explain, actually, with some of the complaints about mishandling my data, that's still technically maladministration by a job centre staff person. So that's still a complaint to the chief executive office or the ombudsman, where I'm going now. But the other half of it, of course, is for the Information Commissioner's Office, and I've got like four or five with them, which are the breaches of the Data Protection Act.
Okay, let's get down to the nitty gritty, though. What of your personal data do you think has been handed to the wrong people?
When back at this Flexible New Deal thing, they would shuffle and send it on to people I hadn't even signed up with.
But what information? I mean, is this your things like your date of birth,
name, address, national insurance number, bits and bobs of information about me, remarks they made about me previously would be handed on. I've even had like comments like this guy is extremely intelligent but he's paranoid. You know, and like stuff.
Well,
like that.
That's saying essentially you're mentally ill, isn't it?
Something like that. But the worst ones have been with the job centre staff themselves, because I actually sat down and I thought, well, I'm going to go through this, and I found, I made a complaint to the Information Commissioner's Office. I found 64 incidences of breaches of my data, and this is where they had made comments. They're supposed to be just recording appointments, times, but they had made comments about me, and there's even like a negative caricature running through the whole thing, like Kaz's avoiding the work program, catch him next time. You know, it's all like I discovered they're after me. I've caught them red-handed falsifying data. So there was some data on it. I thought, well, what on earth is that about? And I investigated it. They actually reported me sick because they forgot to do something as regards to the work programme. So they put me down as sick, which actually counted as I could do that three times and then I'd be sanctioned. So I didn't know. I was a third of the way to being sanctioned for being sick when I've never actually registered with being sick in my life. There's another one. I caught the job centre manager red-handed emailing the district office trying to scupper any future complaint I made by saying, well, don't let him do that, do this sort of thing. So you can see there's a whole building a case against me when actually they're public servants. They're supposed to be serving
me. Well, it doesn't sound
to
me like you were in any way mentally ill, because they were actually plotting against you. You've got evidence of it. Anyway, so you've gone to the ombudsman as well. What's happened with that?
This is where it gets interesting. I mean, because I'd like to talk about the relationship with the Independent Case Examiner and the Ombudsman. The Ombudsman is okay.
Who is this Ombudsman? What are they? What's their actual title?
It's the Parliamentary and Health Service Ombudsman, I think. And that's where you take any complaint about a list of civil service departments. So it would be the NHS, but it includes DWP, Job Centre Plus as well. Now, it used to be that you could, if you weren't happy with the Job Centre Chief Executive Office, I believe that's now called the Chief Operating Officer's Office or something. And in my experience, folks, this is just my belief. I don't think that office actually exists, really, because they always bat things down to district office. So you should go Job Centre District Office Chief Operating Officer, but actually I go Job Centre Chief Operating Officer. I know they're going to bat it down to district level. I get that response and I go to the top office again. So it doesn't actually exist. The thing is, you could go to either then the independent case examiner or the ombudsman. Obviously, it's mega serious. You go to the ombudsman. It used to be just the ombudsman, but they set up the independent case examiner to head off complaints to go to the ombudsman. Now, if they're dealing with them, fine. Nobody's got any problem with that. But as in my case, it seems that they just deliberately tried to scupper it, so I couldn't get to the ombudsman.
What have you? Okay, so you haven't managed to make it to the ombudsman yet.
No, I'm at the ombudsman now.
Oh, you are. Well done.
Because I've recorded all of these complaints, I have about 30 elements of complaints with them now, which will go up to about 45 with the next wave of them. Initially, I have to say the service has been not very good. I mean, I had to wait 5.5 months just for them to tell me they've been busy. Well, that's great. And they basically, I haven't sent them the evidence because I don't want them to do the same as the independent case examiner. So what we've done, I've sent them evidence on some serious, the more serious stuff, so they're satisfied that it's worthy of investigation. Then they'll do an investigation. But here's a key thing, Tony. They want what they want is for an investigation to have been done so that they can have a look at that. And if you go, you know, independent case examiner will swear blind they're independent. But if you go on the ombudsman website, they say that ICE, the independent case examiner, is just an arm's length government body. So it's either independent or it isn't. So you can't really win. But you can go to the ombudsman, get them to settle your elements of complaint if they backed you back down.
Well,
to
this sounds all very, very complex, sort of web you're moving in here. And it's
you
almost
see
like
how
you're
savvy
a,
you have to be to just try and
that's
get
been
something
caught in it, you know. But yeah. Ultimately, you know, what have you learned that you can pass on about how? I mean, particularly getting hold of your. I mean, if people are interested in actually getting hold of what the Department of Work and Pensions hold on you, that file. Including all the sort of notes that advisors are making about you. How will people go about doing that?
Well, they just make a simple subject access request.
Under the Data Protection Act.
Yeah, and there's templates on the Information Commissioner's Office to do that. Or you can just say on a letter, or like what I do, if I'm making a formal complaint about one or two issues and I want some information pertinent to it, I'll just put formal complaint and subject access request. And at the bottom I'll put subject access request in bold, and then I'll say specifically what I want and say what
well,
I don't
because I mean that's everybody's right. It's a bit like the credit rating agencies, isn't it? You know, any information that's actually held about you, you have the right to that information.
Yeah, you also have the right to information of how things are being processed as well, you know. So if they're processing something about you, and I'm trying to get to the bottom at the moment of all these, I keep getting letters of doubt for dates when I'm not claiming JSA. So I'm just trying to get to the bottom of the process, who instigates that process about me and who's responsible for it, because it's victimisation.
What about going to your MP? Have you done that?
Well, you have to go to your MP to go to the ombudsman. I mean, it's a really strange system. I don't agree with it. So you're complaining about a government body, and you have to go to a government gatekeeper who may or may not support you. I had a stand-up row with my MP about this flexible New Deal stuff because it was obviously fleecing the taxpayer. It was obvious large-scale fraud, and he just blatantly wasn't interested. So I fell out with him for that.
Because that's actually come out in the news over the last few weeks, hasn't it?
And I believe it will about the work programme as well.
Yeah, because the companies that have been paid, private companies being paid massive amounts by the Department of Work and Pensions.
Yeah, and you've got these umbrella companies. I think the two is A4E and Working Links. They've already been found to be corrupt.
they've certainly found, I'm not sure about corrupt, but they've certainly found to be not getting the number of people into work that had been being the natural amount that
would
get jobs
if it didn't exist.
This
is my point here. I just want to be left alone to get on with some job seeking rather than have to deal with all this rubbish.
But isn't that the point in all this? That actually what these work programme businesses are there to do is just to hassle you, basically, week after week, a sort of slow...
grind you down.
Yeah, I mean, isn't that what?
Well, I mean, isn't there an analogy there? The work program tries to grind you down, so you just take anything, which might send you into depression or you'll be worse
off. Or become self-employed when you're only doing a few hours a week and break the law. I mean, they then get big payments for that.
Tony, you are just a profit unit. You were a profit unit if you were on the flexible new deal. You're just a profit unit to them if you're on the work program. And if you don't cooperate, they just think, well, if we can't make money, we'll get you. We'll cost you. You're costing us, so we're going to cost you.
Okay. Any finally words of advice for listeners about how to actually make these, either to get off the work program or else to actually make the work program really work for you?
Well, I would check it out and do your research, and if there's something there that's going to benefit you, actually help and support you, by all means, you know, go for that. But you don't have to sign anything. And of course, I'm not saying I'm doing any method or strategy, but as I say, it's actually cheaper for me to sign off and sign on. But you don't have to sign anything. You don't have to do the data protection waiver. I would say, to protect yourself, you have to get into the habit of making formal complaints to your manager or the district manager. And if you want to take it higher than that, if it is serious, you know,
hang on a minute, because you haven't got all that far with your complaints, and yet you're advising other people to do the same.
Well, one thing, you know, I'm not trying to be malicious. I don't go hunting to sort of get somebody I don't like, or I'm not trying to waste people's time. What these people don't understand is I'm trying to help them. So I thought, if I document all of this stuff that's gone on, I mean, Tony, we haven't even touched the service. I had a criminal offence of a malicious call. I was actually threatened one quiet Sunday evening, and because of the language used, it must have come from a letter.
Who by?
Well, this is the thing. I'd actually sent a letter in, and the language this guy used, it was somebody that actually, it was no big deal. They made a bit of a cock up with their reply to me. So I replied, and I just said, well, I think you've got that wrong. You know, according to me, that can't be the case because of this. And I think that person got into trouble. So when I was threatened one Sunday, they used language out of that letter which could only have come from JobSender Plus. Now, that's a serious breach of data protection. It's also a criminal offence. I mean, there's a lot to mention that, you know, breaches of Data Protection and Computer Misuse Act. And there's little bits of fraud as well, where they've tried to defraud me out of money that's legitimately mine when I sign off. So there's some really serious stuff here. I'm not messing about. But it's just, how far can you go to actually get redress? And I think the system is completely broken down. With the independent case examiner, it was complete corruption of process, and I don't believe Job Centre Plus actually has a complaint process, and it's really, really in trouble. I'm trying to help them, and I want the ombudsman to come good and help them. I'm not just out for compensation. I want them to actually give me redress, but actually put right what's wrong. Otherwise, you just have to be savvy and try and protect yourself with you know, a lot of methodology.
Okay, Kazza, thanks very much. And maybe you can report back in a few months' time and tell us how you've been getting on, because it sounds like a fascinating little exercise you're doing there.
Well, thanks ever so much for having me on, Tony. And I'd love to do that and tell you, you know, if the ombudsman has come good and been genuine or not. Either way, we'll find out. Thanks ever so much.
Well, I'm joined now by Jason Yannakopoulos.
Hello, Tony.
Now, Chris Yoon is on the subject this week.
Wow.
Poor old Chris, he's a big fall from grace. Lots and lots of Conservatives laughing and lots of Liberal Democrats crying.
Yeah, it's an interesting story.
Who is this guy?
Well, he was, until recently, the Energy and Climate Change, the Secretary of State for Energy and Climate Change, and before that he was a Liberal Democrat spokesperson for Home Affairs, and then he was I think Liberal Democrat spokesperson for the regions. It's an interesting chap. He was a high-flying Liberal Democrat. He came second twice in Liberal Democrat elections, first to Mengus Campbell and then to Nick Clegg. So a high-ranking Liberal Democrat who's been brought up over and pleaded guilty to perverting the cause of justice.
Yes, it's quite a high sort of charge, that, isn't it?
It's an interesting one. I mean,
I think there's quite a lot of people that do the same offence, as far as I know, that don't actually get any kind of charges. The other thing, of course, is he is very much in the sights of the Tory elite.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because he was anti-nuclear. And he's the energy secretary, right? So, yes. I mean, the thing is that the whole nuclear power station building program is collapsing on its own. It doesn't need a pro-nuclear conservative energy secretary to sort of make it work. So I suppose what I'm suggesting here, I don't know what your thoughts are, is that maybe there are ulterior motives to dredging up through down to 2002, I think it was, through some possible texts and police records to see that he's said his wife was driving when she wasn't.
Well, it's an interesting one, because this is actually a regular occurrence in the House of Commons. You know, they sort of
speeding.
Well, probably. Quite possibly. Certainly there is there's certainly been a history of sort of digging the dirt up on an MP or here and that, and then that makes its way into the press. I don't know if you watched the most recent episode of the new Yes Prime Minister.
Ah, right. When's that on and where?
It's on Tuesday nights, actually.
Oh, right, tonight. That's the night we record the podcast, not the day we go out on FM.
Yeah, it's Tuesday nights at 10, maybe 11 o'clock on Gold. And on the most recent episode, they had the character playing Sir Humphrey, the civil servant, who was unhappy that the Prime Minister was trying to bring in civil service reforms, and he digs up an old bit about the Prime Minister's past as an opposition politician.
Oh.
And they played a little football with that, and I just thought that's wonderfully timed given what's happening here now.
What about his son? Because a lot of nasty texts from his son.
It's really horrid,
in a way, to see these kind of exposed to public view, because you think, well, this is actually a private matter. It's got nothing to do with actually, you know, whether someone's caught speeding or not.
Yeah, it's horrific. I mean, one of the texts that came out was after Chris Hughes tried to wish his son Merry Christmas, I think he texted something like that, saying, "Go away, I don't ever want to talk to you ever again." Because of you, my whole existence has been lies, you know.
Oh dear. What does this say about the UK then?
I think it says that we have a trust problem. You know, we have a trust problem, and that's partly because a lot of the people, you know, are either behaving badly or at least trying to do each other in. So we now have a culture where we are sensationalists, as it were. I mean, they'll go through anything to dig up the dirt on anyone, and I don't think you really get this in other countries.
No? No?
Well, not to the degree we get it here. I mean...
So what next, anyway, for the Lib Dems and the
Well, the Liberal Democrats kind of... Just the whole coalition has kind of shot themselves in the foot, really.
Well, have they?
Throughout the entire coalition, they've shown very little in the way of backbone. So Liberal Democrats were in a bad place, as it were, but because we have sensationalised press, that are willing to push agendas such as this one, it's made it worse for the Liberal Democrats, because, you know, it's just saying, look, Liberal Democrats can't be trusted. And part of me thinks, yes, what he did was bad, but part of me also thinks he makes a nice shield from the Conservative Party.
Well, I think what we should do is a lot of the things that they seem to bad news seems to be announced by Nick Clegg, doesn't it? It seems he comes on the TV or whatever, or on the newspapers, to talk about the bad, really bad stuff, and whilst Cameron is sort of nowhere to be seen. Is that deliberate, do you think?
I think there's definitely a human shield case in there.
Okay, Jason, thanks very much. Anything else you want to talk about this week?
Well, actually, not related to this, on a personal note, and certainly on a note related to Bristol, I'm quite excited because at UW, where I studied, student union elections coming up, and it's going to be a very interesting time.
Okay, so when is the election actually taking place then?
I think it's taking place at the end of February, at the start of March, but nominations open tomorrow, so we will start
this week anyway.
Well, the nominations open this week and close in a few weeks' time, so people get the chance to put their candidacy forward. They have to fill in the forms that I had to fill in. They have to put down their name, who their campaign agent's going to be in, and five other people who would like them to stand as that particular
And they have to do a sort of some sort of jazzed up bit of graphic design, post it all over the place. So the entire university is absolutely covered with these stickers.
Is it really
that whoever gets the snazziest graphic designer, because I mean obviously many of the people who are voting don't actually know the person at all. Do they have hustings and all that kind of thing?
Oh yeah, we have hustings, but I think the bad side of student elections is we have people, like, we had a sign on the door last Yeah, when we were going around the campus, it says, you know, don't bother campaigning here if you don't have sweets. So it's kind of like they want a bit of give and take, really.
Right, so they're saying that if you have got sweets, we'll vote you. Okay.
So it's
student politics saying what it used to be, or maybe it's just always been the same.
Well, it's been an interesting one because... I'm not allowed to say this. You've kind of got in trouble after the last election.
Why?
There was a view that one of the candidates had got elected in an undemocratic procedure.
Not electoral fraud.
Yes. That's kind of exactly what I was
saying. Okay, so that was examined and all found to be possibly fraudulent. That's a shame, isn't it? Because, I mean, you know, this seems to be happening more and more with democratic elections,
well,
that people are undermining them. I'm not just talking about at UWE, and we're not saying that the one at UWE was fraudulent. What I'm saying is, I mean, certainly in the US, Ohio State looks extremely dodgy. And even our own elections, the postal vote system is incredibly open to abuse.
I mean, that's one of the few.
So UWE isn't on its own, is it?
UWE isn't on its own, no. It's it got a stern telling off from the NUS, so hopefully this year's better, which is why I'm absolutely looking forward to this year's contest.
Remember, all right, well, keep us in touch with that, Jason. Yeah. But this week, you are Jeff, aren't you?
This week I am Jeff, indeed. So I'm afraid I can't do the voice, so I hope you'll forgive me for that. So this is the What's On Guide, from Dialect. Starting Friday the 8th of February, To Remain Silent will be performing with support from Area 53 and Seal Club at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £4 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Also on the 8th of February, Whole Lot of Lead will be performing at the Cheese and Grain in Market Yard, Frome. Tickets are £12.50 in advance and doors open at 8 p.m. On to the Song of the Week, and I present The Union. This group formed in 2009 and have to date released 2 albums, 6 singles, and include Luke Morley of Thunder and also Pete Shoulder of Winterville fame. This is from their second album, Siren's Song, released in 2011, and the song is called If I Could Make You Mine.
Heaven stopped to wonder when nothing works and tears start to fall, I'd do anything to stop you crying.
That was The Union with If I Could Make You Mine from the album Siren Song. For more information, you can check out www.theuniononline.com. Moving into Saturday, the 9th of February, the Bon Jovi Experience will be performing at the Fleece in St. Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets £12 in advance and doors open at 8 p.m. Finally, on Sunday, the 10th of February, the Nick Malcolm Quartet will be performing at the Coronation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. Entry is £3 on the door and doors open at 4 p.m. That is all for me. Thank you for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect's a weekly podcast for your MP3 player produced by volunteers, broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 2 o'clock every Friday afternoon. And I will be bringing you, if you're listening on FM, the BCFM Politics Show Friday Drive Time every Friday from 5 till 7. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. So, Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and anyone can contribute if you'd like to. Do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol 0117 989 7733, and you can find them at the web on bristolvolunteers.org.uk. I'm Tony Gosney. Thank you for listening. Until the same time next week, goodbye.
Mercury's and Subaru, and you don't stop, you keep on eating cars. Then shot, 'cause the man from Mars stopped eating cars and eating bars, and now he only eats guitars. Yeah.